For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kip Lanford. In the cave with me, Mr. Mark Tuttle, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, and to go back to a very, very old laugh-in poem, if your lawyer's asleep, you better give him a nudge, and he's got to wake up, because here come the judge. We have Judge Scott Cirque in the studio with us today. There are a million topics that we can approach a legal mind about, and so I'm going to sit back and throw it to you guys and see what happens.
Yeah, these days the preamble to Charles Dickens' Tale of Two Cities, you know, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got extremes on all sides of just about every issue going on. So when it comes to jurisprudence, when it comes to legal matters, when it comes to faith and politics, it seems like we've got extreme good and extreme bad going on in our culture all at the same time.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think all the issues are reflecting that extreme good, extreme bad. Ultimately, I think a lot of these issues ultimately go back to the garden. And we either want to do it God's way or we either want to do it our way. And I think ultimately that's where a lot of the division comes. It can be complicated. But in the end, there's the tough choices are the simple choices to do right or to do wrong, and that's what we're facing in a lot of these issues.
Well, you know, a lot of people look at it, and they don't go so much back to the garden as they do. They go back to the founding of our country.
Very true.
And there's a lot of question, I think a lot of anxiety in the air right now, not only among people that are, I would say, the perennial skeptics. You know, there's this class of people that they're never going to be happy. They're always going to be discontent. They're always going to be critical of America. And so, you know, their rhetoric and what they're saying about, well, the American system's broken. This isn't what the founding fathers intended. We're way off the reservation. I'm seeing that getting picked up by a lot of people that I would say would be more on the patriotic side of things. You know, there's a there's this, it's been going around for a few years. There's this call for a new constitutional convention to be called a convention of states to look at things. So the question comes up, a couple of different questions come up with that. You know, first off, is the American system still intact? Is it still working? Is it still government for the people, by the people, of the people that it was founded to be? And then the second question is one that's been around for a while, too. How compatible is Catholicism really to this whole American system? So I think we should dive in and discuss.
Those are some big questions.
They are. But that's what we're here for, Tim. We're here to tackle some of those big questions and dive in a little bit deep and try to get beneath the surface. So,
and Judge Cirque will be our lifeguard.
Right. I'll try my best. What you were saying there is compatible with the American system. I've been recently reading George Will's book, Conservative Sensibility. He says that we basically divide between two presidents, Madison, who supported the founding and the founding of the Constitution, and then Woodrow Wilson, who was the first president to say it was wrong and that we need to have a totally different view. And then he follows that up a little bit with TR, FDR, and of course Obama in that strain, as opposed to the Madisonian view as well. So I find that interesting. The other thing that when you were going through the constitutional conflict, I mean, not to be political, but we have the Democratic debate tonight, and some of the points that they're saying is, you know, change the makeup of the Supreme Court, have reparations for slavery, reparations for gay couples, forgive all student debt. I mean, it is totally changing the Constitution and how we look at that. So we are in a time where the conflicts or the differing views are there of those two aspects.
I think it comes down to, as I think part of what adds to this polarization that we're seeing is that, going back to something you mentioned, Mark, about, you know, is this country really, you know, still, you know, buying for the people? Well, the people, though, to be entrusted with freedom and democracy, have to be formed with a certain moral character. And that, I think, is where the problem lies, is that you want to entrust freedom to good people. You don't want bad people to be free to run around and create havoc and mayhem.
Right. Yeah, as Judge Sirk was saying before, it all goes back to sin. It all goes back to the Garden of Eden and you know, that original choice. And yeah, I guess the question then comes, how much of a responsibility does the government have to not fall into this idea of absolute complete freedom that would lead to anarchy, but to rein in some of that and kind of deal with the sinfulness of man and try to keep man on the straight and narrow?
Yeah, John Adams said when they created the government, he said it can only be done by a faithful religious people, and other of our leaders were like that as well. The Madisonian founding of the Constitution was based on the natural law, and there's a real attack on that too when you get into the conflict that we have today. As Mark said, the best of times and the worst of times. So those are all issues that we have to address and work through.
So this Madisonian view of America, the constitutional view, is it what we all got in civics class when we were in high school? You know, the three branches of government where there's checks and balances on each other, no concentration of power in one or the other. The idea is to reserve as much freedom and as much responsibility for governance to the states as possible, and from there on, it's protecting natural rights of property and freedom of speech and freedom of the press and all of that. Is that Madisonian view, or is there more to it?
That's how I would sum it up as a great synopsis, and I think that's accurate. That is the belief. Yes.
Yeah, and then the Wilsonian view. What exactly is
that?
Well,
Wilson felt that it was. That wouldn't be effective for how times had changed. And then you even get to FDR, who was critical of the Bill of Rights and saying that government should not do things as opposed to government should provide those things. And that's kind of the thinking that we have from the more progressive view, that government is the arbiter, the kind of the final arbiter, whereas the Madisonian view, Scalia also himself says one of the great things that we did was the Constitution and the framework, the division of the separate branches, so nothing can be done easily. So, you know, that is the focus in that we have basically freedom from government as opposed to government being our dominant force or creator, the one we look to for our rights. And It's a hard sell in today's world, but there's a lot of that there, particularly the healthcare issue.
Yeah, because when you talk about nothing being easy, boy, howdy, does that seem true when you look at Washington right now.
Right. But that's how they set it up, so that the majority cannot run roughshod over the minority, those type of things. The majority view cannot run roughshod over the minority view.
What do you think, Judge, might be some of the implications of our country is becoming increasingly more and more non-religious or more secular? What are some of the implications from, you know, say, a law standpoint and our ability to have, you know, good laws, enforce the laws, have people follow the laws? Or what might flow from secularization in terms of problems, or are there any benefits?
That is a fascinating question. I think that we're seeing that in the culture throughout. I think part of the fact of secularization has been the breakdown of the marriage. You know, something we never talk about, but has had tremendous effect is no-fault divorce.
Oh yeah.
And again, when we approach marriage with the religious or the sacramental view that it had before. There's more of a focus on the children, the community, and those things, and that the divorce affects everyone. It's just not that I'm not happy in the marriage. Now, there's, of course, with everything, there's balances to it. You don't want people to be in harmful marriages and things like that. But I think that is indicative of the secularization that has occurred, and that's something that no one wants to touch. But again, I think that's a factor that's out there. And so, again, our founders, while they were not religious as such, they had great, even Jefferson, who certainly was not religious, had great respect for religion. I think in the culture wars and the secularization that's happened since then, that has been lost by to the people who are not religious but active in the public squares, they should be, and I think that has grave effects and consequences.
Yeah, the breakdown of the family, I think, is front and center when you look at secularization. There was a book that came out by Mary Eberstadt probably about 2 years ago, and what she points out in that book is that when people think about this relationship between family and religion, they often get the cart before the horse. And they think that religion is what goes into forming good families. And she says it's quite the opposite. That when you have solid, intact families, that's the carrier for religion generation to generation. And so that as the families have broken down, that's why religion is not getting passed on to the next generation. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. That makes a lot of sense.
She's a tremendous author. She also did the book recently, The Loser Letters.
That's a great one.
Tremendous in this whole the atheistic, the secular culture, and what harm it's causing actually in our community and with everyone. But and then the book you were mentioning, I believe, is relates to Adam and Eve. I can't think of the title.
Oh, Adam and Eve After the Pill?
After the Pill.
Yeah.
No, actually,
there's another one.
Yeah, there's another one, right. I want to say boy.
She's got a bunch of books.
She's tremendous.
I think Adam and Eve After the Pill is kind of how, as I remember that one, which is another fascinating point that she points out, that we've moved our sexual the taboos that we used to have about different sexual activity, and we've transferred those taboos from sexuality to food.
Yeah,
that there's a lot more food taboos about where, you know, GMOs and organics and the rise of whole foods and all that, and versus all the traditional taboos around different sexual activity. Those are all gone. There are no things. So.
Yeah, the irony of that was clear in Madison, Wisconsin. They have a large farmers market up there, and the Diocese of Madison, their Office of Marriage and Family took it upon themselves to purchase a booth there at the farmers market. And so they had, they printed up pamphlets and literature that didn't talk about birth control or the pill from the context of religion, but they talked about it from the context of pure living, organic. You know, why would you go out of your way to come to a farmer's market to avoid hormones in your beef and then take a pill to, you know,
that's put hormones,
hormones in your body? And so, you know, the disconnect there was pretty obvious when they were there, and they got a lot of traffic, but there were a lot of people that turned up their nose at that message.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, and that's part of her book too. Was that she said in the 50s, housewives would have very nice ashtrays and would allow smoking and encourage it, but they would absolutely be appalled at any sexual innuendo. And she says now it's just totally flipped. Not necessarily housewives, of course, but that smoking is...
Oh, yeah, you can't do that. Unless it's marijuana.
But then the over-sexualized culture has really dominated.
All right, we need to take a break, and we'll be back with more with Judge Scott Cirque in just a minute. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you been married and have since divorced? Do you think your marital status prevents you from coming to church? Most Catholics and non-Catholics unfortunately have a lot of misconceptions about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Pope Francis has recently encouraged all people with questions about marriage to make an appointment and talk with their parish priest. As Catholic priests, we look forward to the opportunity to help you on your journey through life. Please make an appointment to speak with the priest today. We are and will always be here for you.
You're on a journey, in a race, in the company of others.
Imperfection makes you human. Forgiveness offers life, and opportunity brings hope.
Good news and great company. Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, here with Timothy O'Donnell.
Hello!
Kent Blanford.
Yep.
And we have Judge Scott Cirque here in studio with us. And we are talking, of course, since we have Judge Cirque with us, we're talking a little bit about politics. We're talking about faith, the intersection of both. And we were talking about the founding in the last segment. We were talking about kind of the two presidents, that you have the Madisonian view of government and how our country was founded. And then you have the more progressive Wilsonian view that the government is really there to bestow on people certain rights, certain goods. The healthcare comes from that. A lot of our regulation of business comes from that mentality. And it brought to mind a theory that's been put out there by the political science professor up at Notre Dame, Patrick Deneen. And that is that what we're seeing in America is sort of the natural outgrowth of the founding. That those two aren't two different things. They're just two different sides of the same coin. And that when America was founded, you had a bunch of immigrant communities coming over, people immigrating to the United States to get away from Leviathan. And then you had this Enlightenment thought that simply brought and established a government completely based upon the same thoughts that brought about Leviathan in the in Europe. And so even though you had the checks and balances, even though you had the Constitution on paper, that Enlightenment code is starting to eat away at the natural communities that are here, at family life, at community life. And what we're seeing right now is just sort of the natural, sort of offshoot of that. So I thought I'd bring that up and kind of get your thought, Judge Cirque, on is he right? Is he wrong? Is there some truth to it? Or is it just completely, absolutely off the wall?
No, I definitely think there's some truth to that, and it's a constant conflict in our political system, as he's pointing out. Whether we focus on the natural law, which is that we are born with certain rights that government cannot infringe upon, or we approach it differently, as you said, and there is always going to be that conflict, and I think that's really how we're going through that now. And when we always look to government for the solution, as opposed to looking to the church or the family or other aspects, I think that leads to these two differing views in regard to this.
It seems too that the more we look towards government, especially federal government, it inverts subsidiarity.
Yeah.
And when we lose subsidiarity, we naturally grow. It leads to the growth of government. And then government, as it grows in power and influence. And the government has the power of coercion, right? That's part of what military and law enforcement have. They have the power of coercion to get one to abide by laws. So it seems that I think part of what Deneen was talking about in his most recent book, Why Liberalism Failed, he champions that liberalism actually, because of its success, is exactly why it's failing. And it seems to me one of those themes is that as we as a people seek out more and more autonomy, rights, and freedom to do whatever we want, that inevitably is going to cause us to come in conflict with one another. And our appeal then is to a governmental agency, whether it's local, state, or federal, to secure my rights to do what I want to do over and against those who I'm coming in contact with. And so we see that, I think, a prominent recent example is in the SCOTUS decision around same-sex so-called marriage, in that You have individuals that wanted to exert, pursue a what they understood to be a kind of right, which is to enter into these same-sex unions. It was being battled out across different states and legislature and things like that, and the courts, and then in one fell swoop, the Supreme Court hands down a decision that changes the law for the whole country without without regard for the opposing views. And so that to me is an example of where government has grown in power and might to now, and now we're starting to see that there are other implications that are flowing from that Supreme Court decision as people attempt to live out same-sex marriages, and they come in conflict with other mediating institutions.
When you mentioned the title, Why Liberalism Failed, and recently reading George Will's book, in the 1960s, they asked the American public, how confident are you that the federal government will do a good job? And 80% said they were confident. During the Obama administration, and through the Trump years, they asked the American people, how confident are you to do the federal government do a good job? And you know what percentage it was? Less than 20%.
Oh, wow. It's really
fallen.
Yeah.
We have no that view that, you know, when LBJ, when Lyndon Johnson took the presidency, there was one national government handout, and that my term may not be correct, but it was Social Security.
Mm-hmm. Right.
By the end of his presidency, that had totally changed. It meant all of these things, and it's only gotten worse. So, the belief that they had that government can fix the things, we've now lived through this time and I think our general view is no. Now, government has a role, and right. We've all agreed, we all accept some government to help the less fortunate, but how far we go with that and how much success we can have with that is a very interesting thing. And the last thing, Tim mentioning subsidiarity, that's such a key Catholic theme, and that's what Catholicism tries to teach. Scalia believed in that, and if you proceed that way, it's a more effective way of leadership, government, and those type of things.
Yeah, that concept of subsidiarity, I think, is the lost concept within the church's social teaching that really needs to be revised. So, you know, the idea is that when something needs to be done, it needs to be done at the smallest unit or the smallest community possible. Mm-hmm. So, and therefore, what you're doing is you're empowering and you're enabling first the family, and then the local church, and then beyond that, then you're empowering, you know, the higher levels of community and state and institutions above that. And what that does is, I think that protects those families.
And recently I was listening to Catholic Answers, and the host on that show, their Friday show where they have a general discussion, he was saying he thought one of the problems in the church was the bishops have too large of an area. They cannot be the pastor that they need to be, and there needs to be more bishops. Of course, that gets into the whole vocation crisis and all that. Uh-huh. It's probably one of the reasons. But if our diocese were smaller and you had more contact, that it would people would relate more to those issues or could go to that. So there's an aspect of
and
it.
I think that
practicality.
That goes back to the erosion of community that we were talking about before. And the question I think that comes up is how inevitable is that? You know, if you go back to Thomas Hobbes and you know, Hobbes' basic theory is that mankind is generally misanthropic. We really dislike each other at heart.
Right.
You know, you are my rival, I'm your rival. If
war is kind of a natural state.
If you go out and you find that mammoth, I can't find that mammoth. So, you know, if you're taking my mammoth, I got to do something about it. And so inevitably there's going to be conflict, and inevitably I'm going to go after you so that you don't kill any more of my mammoth. and so what government does is it mediates that. You know, government is the one that protects me from Tim the mammoth killer.
Right.
And and so, you know, when you talk about in America, the government taking on a larger and larger responsibility and subsidiarity getting, you know, pushed under the rug as you see this growth of the federal government coming in and taking more and more responsibility, which side of the coin is the one generating that? Is that from the government pushing its way into life more and more, or is it from the other side of it? Is it the breakdown of community? Is it that natural rivalry that comes up between us, that we're turning more and more to government and we're asking for it? We're demanding government to interfere in these areas.
I think the breakdown of the family creates a vacuum that government will fill, or people who wish to have that power and tell us what to do, they'll fill that. And so that's something we always have to be aware of. You mentioning Hobbes, on EWTN's show Saints and Scoundrels, they recently had Hobbes with Chesterton.
It was
a very interesting take on that, because Chesterton loved humanity.
You're right.
But he had a very practical view of it. So, yeah, I think it's a fascinating conflict. But wherever there's a vacuum, certain people want to tell us how to live our lives. They'll fill that. And our friends on the left believe that that's what we religious people do, where I think where if we follow our faith, follow the Catholicism, we love the individual, we hate the sin, and we're not judging. So we want people to live and go forward. The handmaid tale and all that is really a false attack, but it's how the left perceives us through misunderstanding.
Well, the left sees the rivalry there between the federal government as it's growing and the church. And they see that where the church used to be that arbiter between people, and it used to be that which brought us to forgiveness, and it used to be that which taught us how to live with each other and how to live in community and how to live in family. Now, the government is the one that's supposed to teach us how to live together, and the government is the one that's supposed to be our arbiters, and the government's the one that's supposed to form these communities. And so the rivalry there, I think the left perceives it in a lot of ways better than the right does.
I think that's an excellent point.
Yeah, and with that, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
You know us as Catholic Radio Indy, but we're so much more than just radio. We're a website, CatholicRadioIndy.org, with access to great Catholic resources, including podcasts of all our local programming, podcasts that have been downloaded from all 50 states and over 40 countries on 6 continents. Yes, we are Catholic Radio Indy, but thanks to your support, we're taking the gospel of Christ to the ends of the earth. Catholic Radio Indy and CatholicRadioIndy.org.
You can hear the Holy Mass every day at 8 a.m. right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm still Timothy O'Donnell, Mammoth Killer, and according to Mark, Mark's in studio. And we have the great pleasure of having Judge Scott Cirk with us. And where we left off, or where I'd like us to pick up, is we're talking about faith and law and subsidiarity. I think, and how, as religion is pushed out of the public square, or as the sphere of religion shrinks or is eclipsed by the sphere of government, one of the problems, I want to get your take on this, Judge. One of the problems, it seems to me, is that until fairly recently in America, we had a common moral code that's based on the Ten Commandments, a Judeo-Christian view of things, but then also animated by, say, the gospel and gospel values, especially like the Beatitudes. It was kind of the common moral framework that we all shared and formed sort of the basic conceptual framework from which we would engage each other in, say, public discourse in pursuit of the common good. As religion is, again, sort of pushed out of the public square, or our ability to hand on the faith is continuing to be diminished, we're being ineffective at it, then it seems to me, though, that creates a vacuum for a different moral code to emerge. And it's one that we may not agree with, especially as Catholics. What do you see in terms of, like, for example, you brought up natural law. Well, natural law is, I think, increasingly taught less and less. It's understood less and less. And therefore, our appeals to natural law often can fall on deaf ears because people don't even know what we're talking about. But what's your view on the state of sort of the moral code as we're moving forward in today's setting?
Well, I think the moral code isn't known. It would be my first response. You know, Justice Scalia, in his book On Faith, he refers to a 1952 decision that was written by William O. Douglas, who was one of the most liberal members of the Supreme Court ever, appointed by FDR. But he said in a case in 1952, he said, "We are a religious people whose constitution presupposes a supreme being." Mm-hmm. And if you heard that today in 2019, you would think that was Clarence Thomas, right?
Right, right.
That's part of what, so we've lost that. And I think what's replaced it is, again, we have been so blessed as Catholics by our great recent popes, Pope John Paul II, of course, and Pope Benedict XVI, who really stressed relativism.
Mm-hmm.
And like when I speak to my recent college graduate children, they are imbued more with mm-hmm. relativism. Mm-hmm. You know, how can I say, you know, this is wrong? And I think, mm-hmm. or how can you say this is wrong? Or, you know, this type of thing. So I think relativism is really is the thing we need to attack or address, and I think that's more in the culture, in the air of the culture, than when we, you know, I'm 57 years of age. When I was a kid, you knew the story of the prodigal son. You knew mm-hmm. there were certain things just in there. Even if you didn't go to church every Sunday mm-hmm. and attend Mass, you heard those things. It was more in the culture, you know, as opposed to Ozzie and Harriet culture, or Leave It to Beaver culture, or in a Homer Simpson culture,
right?
So or worse, a House of Cards culture, or a Game of Thrones culture.
Oh, right.
Netflix, yeah. HBO, you know,
Handmaid's Tale.
So, so that's changing us, and that. But now I believe in the American people. I believe we'll turn around. You can never bet against the American people. Mm-hmm. I think I have that confidence in us, but we have. There's been a shift.
Yeah, I think the relativism brings about there's a destructive force to not just the moral code, but I think our civic code as well from relativism. You know, our system was set up based on the idea, to a certain extent, of majority rights. So, you know, when the majority of people got together and there was consensus on something, that was what was supposed to rule the day. That was kind of the general idea behind our system. That doesn't work in a relativist system. In a relativist system, it has to be the strongest minority that prevails. So when you've got a view, and let's say my view is against Tim's view, which is against mm-hmm. somebody else's view, whichever of us is stronger, that's what's going to prevail. And so what you wind up with is you wind up with the strongest minority view being the one that carries the day. And our system was never set up mm-hmm. to be able to deal with that. And I think a lot of our you know, a lot of the coarseness in our dialogue, our civic dialogue, comes from that. We're not trying to come to consensus anymore. We're trying to assert, you know, my view over the 10 other views that are out there. And as long as I'm the loudest and I have the most people behind me shouting it, you know, I'm going to prevail. And so, you know, and as I said, that's not the way our system was set up. Our system was set up to come to consensus, to come to agreement, to the point when you had a majority of people in agreement of what was supposed to happen, and then that's what was going to happen.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the big problems, I think you're right, but one of the principles we've abandoned, though, is our commitment to seek the truth. The truth today, many that I engage in conversation with would say that the truth is really unknowable, and that they deny objective truth, which is relativism. And if no such thing as objective truth exists, then it's reduced to just simply personal opinions, preferences, and perspectives, which is very Nietzschean. And then that results in that contest of wills that you're describing, Mark, that ultimately makes an appeal to power to resolve the conflict.
Yeah, and even if it's not as strong a view of there is no truth or the truth is unknowable, what's prevalent is a weaker view of that that says, well, there's truth, but it can only be known through science and through experimentation and through measurement.
Oh, the scientific method,
Anything outside of that is unknowable and unresolvable. And so when it comes to history or politics or religion, there the truth is unknowable.
Yeah, or morality, just morality and ethics.
How is the best response to that argument? What is, because like sometimes when we respond that there is truth, you're only doing that through your religious faith. Uh-huh. You know, like to me, there's an absolute truth of God exists, but other people don't accept that initial truth. So what's the best argument against that?
I think one of the ways I try to open up that conversation, say in an ethics class, would be to ask if anyone has an example of any universal moral laws, and then I'll provide an example if no one can come up with one. So by universal moral laws, I mean universal meaning applies to everyone. There's no person or group that's an exception to who it applies to. Moral. So it's there's a right and wrong, a good and an evil, and then a law meaning that it has. It's an ordinance of reason, and that it has the force of truth behind it. So when I ask, are there any universal moral laws? The most common one, set code that people know exist, whether they believe in it, believe in them or not, or follow them or not, are the Ten Commandments. And that again sounds like a religious appeal, but then I'll say, okay, well, I'll give you another one. I'll make this statement. I'll say, rape is always wrong. Rape is always wrong as an example of a universal moral law. In other words, rape is the kind of violation of one's of another person such that there cannot be any justification for it. And I think I've never met anyone who disagreed with the statement.
I would hope not.
Right, exactly. And that's not to say that rape doesn't happen, or that rape or that there haven't been cultures or subsegments of culture that have employed rape, say, in as ways to subjugate, adversaries or opponents, say, in warfare, things like that, where they see it as a sort of quote-unquote good. It's not to say that doesn't, but whenever we find rape occurring and someone embracing it, we point out that they're wrong, that they're mistaken, regardless of how they're so that reveals that kind of objective nature, that there are certain principles, there are certain acts that are universal, they're moral, so they could be right or wrong, and that it points to an objective truth, and the law is there to reveal to us and guide and direct our actions. Another one I throw out that's a little more tongue in cheek is, it's always wrong to torture toddlers for fun. And I've not had anyone disagree with that statement.
Good, I'm glad.
Exactly. And there's any number of these things you can do. But you begin to ask, then you just simply begin to ask, well, if you'd see that those two things are true, then they're universal moral law. So now we know that they have kind of an eternal transcendent quality to them because they're not conditioned on the individual person. Then our next question is really, are there any others? So that begins the process of inquiry into moral good and the objective moral truth. Are there other principles that we can discover by using reason? And
why that works is because you've made morality practical, which is where morality ultimately belongs. I think we've gotten duped in our times into thinking that morality is something theoretical. And if you go back and you look at the scholastics, if you look at St. Thomas Aquinas and others, they would label morality and ethics as a practical science. And so, you know, it's a how-to. It's a how do I get from point A to point B? Well, I have to follow, you know, this step. And I think when you break it down that way, most of us will actually agree on what that point B that we're all trying to get to actually is. And then we can talk about the steps and the moral steps of how to get there, how to live a good life, how to be a good person, how to be a good citizen. There's a lot more agreement on those concepts when you break it down that way than I think there is if you just talk about right and wrong and good and bad and move morality into a more theoretical plane. I'm sure in your courtroom you kind of see that in play a little bit, that if you're dealing with practical problems in real people's lives, it's not hard to lay out a course for how to amend that, how to get from point A to point B. But when things get too theoretical and out there, that's when you have the disputes about what's right and what's wrong.
Well, when Tim was talking, and particularly on rape, I, as a judge, even as a prosecutor and defense attorney, I've had those type of cases, and they're very, when you get into the court situation, you know, one person believes it's a rape and the other believes it's consensual, and then that you get into a very murky area there.
But that's a disagreement on the facts,
that's
not a disagreement
on the
theory.
But right. Not on the theory, and that's very, very true. But I find that very fascinating. Yeah.
And we need to take a break. We'll be back with more with Judge Scott Cirque right after this. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
You can hear the Holy Mass every day at 8 a.m. right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
You know us as Catholic Radio Indy, but we're so much more than just radio. We're a voice for the Church that's seldom heard in our chaotic world. We're confirmation for the strong of faith and encouragement and answers for those in doubt. We're there to rejoice with your triumphs and to be a voice of consolation through the dark times. We're a voice for vocations and proudly pro-life. We are Catholic Radio Indy and CatholicRadioIndy.org.
Ever since we've been on the air at Catholic Radio, we've always wanted to have billboards, but they just don't fit in our budget. And since you'll probably never see a real billboard for us, I'm going to ask you to do something, to imagine one. In your mind, picture a large, empty billboard. Yeah, that's it. Now pick a background color, any color at all. Okay, then across the top of your billboard, put just two words, Catholic Radio. Make them really big. Then below that, in even bigger letters, put 89.1 and 90.9 FM. Wow, that's a great billboard. Now, if this billboard were real, all of your friends and neighbors could see it, and they'd know all about Catholic Radio. But since it's only an imaginary billboard, we're going to have to depend on you to tell your friends about Catholic Radio. Remember, Catholic Radio 89.1 and 90.9 FM. Oh, and by the way, nice choice on that background color. It really looks good.
Welcome back once again to The Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell, Judge Scott Cirque here in studio. And we've been talking about just about everything today.
Right.
But we've been talking about sort of in general, I think, the erosion of community life, the erosion of civic life. And it seems like, in a lot of people's perceptions, things are boiling up and coming to a crisis point in our culture, that we're headed to a point of no return, where we're not going to be able to turn things back and we're not going to be able to correct the trajectory that we're on. That seems very pessimistic to me. I mean, that seems like a very skeptical view of things, but there may be some truth to it. So I thought I would turn that around and ask you, Judge Skirt, and you too, Tim, what do you guys think about that? Are we past a point of no return, or can we turn the ship around?
Well, I always, like I said earlier, I always believe in the American people in general, and then I also think it's just the theme from time immemorial. We people turn away from the truce, and they go on their own, and there's failure and chaos, and then they are led back. I think that's a theme of the Old Testament. Consistently, the prophets come and lead them back to the truth. So I think we can turn around. I believe we will, and I believe that, the Ten Commandments, they're there because they work. They're there, you know, that's, if you live that way, you have a better and more successful life. So I think eventually people will come around and see the truth, that the objective truth that does exist.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with that assessment. I do think it's going to get a lot tougher before it gets better. So there's this, the church itself is, continuing. You know, we started the Summer of Shame a year ago. The church, it has a lot to go through, I think, in terms of purification conversion. There's a lot of headwind in front of us. But at the same time, I take a lot of comfort in the messages of Fatima, where it's Our Lady, prophetically told us we were going to be in for these tough times, and what the remedy is for, and that's really, it's prayer, it's penance, it's receiving the sacraments worthily. I think ultimately, as large elements of our culture sink into increasingly, I would say, disturbing, sometimes disgusting depravity of things, they're going to find out that they're going to be very miserable. And when you're miserable, you're looking for some relief and a better way of living. And I think that's where Catholics in particular, who are living their faith to the full, can bear that kind of witness. And I think we saw that in the early church and how that converted the Roman culture, pagan yeah. culture. And that will be our opportunity as well, especially if we suffer persecution. How we bear up under persecution, that kind of adversity, that those crosses that our Lord, you remember, the closer we draw to Christ, the more in his bitter passion we're going to experience. And so we need to be prepared for that and find joy and love in that.
Yeah, you brought up Our Lady at Fatima, and she was prophetic in the nature of, I think, this deterioration. She pointed to the sexual immorality and said, souls are bombarding hell like snowflakes,
right?
Because of the sexual immorality.
Correct.
And that ultimately, when we're talking about family breakdown, when we're talking about the breakdown of community, we're talking about the erosion of sort of our institutions and all of that. It all starts from that basic disregard and almost sacrilegious view of marriage that comes from, I don't know, that basic temptation between man and woman that started this whole thing with Adam and Eve. It starts with sexual sin and not honoring marriage that comes from, as you pointed out at the beginning, no fault divorce.
Yeah, well, and it's mm-hmm. definitely a factor. And when both you were mentioning Our Lady of Fatima, I mean, a gist of what she was saying is return to the sacraments, uh-huh. Return to the church. But yes, those are all factors. I always think, we are living in a time where there's great sin, but there's also, we've lived in a time where there's been great saints. I think uh-huh. of the recent saints, John Paul II and Mother Teresa, mm-hmm. when they walked the earth, they did things and acted in ways that drew people to them that were not of just the average. So I think those are all things that help and bring us through this time. But also, like what Tim said, the church survived the Roman persecution by its faithfulness, by its example. And I guess that's how we need yeah. to live as individuals and in our own world. Today happens to be the feast day of Saint Jose Maria.
Escriva.
Yeah.
And his big thing, despite other things, was where you're at, try to live the faith, uh-huh. be an example. And I think, and also it's a very man, the way is a very manly type of spirituality. And we need men in the culture. And I think men are under attack. So,
yeah.
Well, I also would offer as a tremendous resource theology of the body.
That's tremendous.
Right?
Yes.
When you read theology of the body, or even some, there's some other great works that are kind of that are more summarizations of it and paraphrasing that's help make can make it a little more accessible. But in the theology of the body, what we have is a profound, deep meditation on the truths of creation, of God making us male and female, and the purposes of, say, sexual activity and intimacy and procreation. That, to me, is a renewal to revisit or maybe discover for the first time that resource, because of the not just the beauty of the writings and the truths that are shared, but it's a kind of antidote or remedy for many of the challenges that we're facing today in the culture, whether it's the attack on marriage, whether it's I think you're right, Judge, that there's a crisis of manhood and men stepping up to their responsibilities and maturing. Again, same-sex marriages. These are all things that the theology of the body can help us fundamentally understand. I think as I've talked to people about the same-sex, so-called marriage, one of the fundamental points of disagreement, or where I try to go fundamentally, is I have to ask the person, do they believe that homosexual activity, not the orientation itself, but the activity, is that wrong or sinful? And if the answer is they don't think it's wrong or sinful, then things that flow from, say, same-sex union, same-sex so-called marriage, then of course those are all going to be permissible and licit in their mind. And so arguing about that or trying to engage in conversation about that isn't going to go anywhere. So I think we have to almost go back more fundamentally and go into more of a fundamental, foundational understanding of what it means to be created male and female and the purposes of our lives, the purposes of our sexuality and our gender, in light of God's plan and the immortality of the soul that each person bears, and to bear witness to that and inform ourselves so that we can have productive, constructive dialogues. Because one of the so we can engage in things like what corporal and spiritual works of mercy. I think that's what I'm thinking of.
Excellent point. When you said that, it made me think of Humanae Vitae.
Yes,
you go right. That goes mm-hmm. to the fundamental issues, and Pope Paul VI in Humanae Vitae said, if the church allows contraceptives, you're going to have increased objectivity of women, you're going to have increased mm-hmm. abortion, you're going to have less respect for marriage. And of course, when he said mm-hmm. that in 1968, he was attacked.
Right.
And
they thought he was crazy.
Even the church,
yeah, an alarmist,
didn't support it that well. But mm-hmm. in truth, as we sit here in 2019, the celibate pontiff was more accurate than the quote-unquote experts as to what, and so that's what I would say with that. Our good friends that, we all know people are homosexual and we love them as individuals, but to continue in that practice, where does it stop? And that's what Pope Paul VI was saying, and there's very dangerous things if you don't set that up.
Yep, and Theology of the Body and Humanae Vitae, I think they both insert that idea of purposes and purposeful life mm-hmm. back into family life and back into community life as well. So if you don't have an understanding that you are directed towards higher purposes, that you're mm-hmm. directed towards something Excellent. Beyond your own immediate gratification, then family life doesn't make any sense, because family life's full of sacrifices. It's
right.
full of setting aside my immediate gratification for some sort of higher good, not only right. for my own family, but for the community. And so, you got to point people and orient them towards the higher goods and show that you were created, you were made physically to exist beyond yourself, to exist above and beyond yourself. And that's built into your very DNA and built into your very identity as a person. Once we can get that rolling again and kind of back within the public discourse, I think a lot of these things just sort of naturally fall into place.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Excellent point.
And that's where we're going to leave this episode of The Catholic Cave. For Judge Scott Cirque, for Tim O'Donnell, for Mark Tuttle, I'm Kent Blanford. Until next time, may God bless.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.